More water sloshed in my mouth. I spit most of it out, but some went down, making me cough and half retch. I started to sink below the surface and fought my way back up, not swimming but only splashing wildly, expending 9 times the energy I needed to stay afloat. Panic made its first appearance, nibbling through my dazed bewilderment with sharp little rat teeth. I realized I could hear a high, sweet buzzing. How many blows had my poor old head taken? One from Whitmore's fist, one from DeVore's cane, one rock, or had it been two? Christ, I couldn't remember. Get hold of yourself, for God's sake. You're not going to let him beat you this way, are you? Drown you like that little boy was drowned? No, not if I could help it. I trod water and ran my left hand down the back of my head. Not too far above the nape, I encountered a goose egg that was still rising. When I pressed on it, the pain made me feel like throwing up and fainting at the same time. Tears rose in my eyes and rolled down my cheeks. There were only traces of blood on the tips of my fingers when I looked at them, but it was hard to tell about cuts when you were in the water.
You look like a woodchuck caught out in the rain, Noonan.
Now his voice seemed to roll to where I was, as if across a great distance.
Fuck you, I called. I'll see you in jail for this.
He looked at Whitmore. She looked back with an identical expression, and they both laughed. If someone had put an Uzi in my hands at that moment, I would have killed them both with no hesitation, and then asked for a second clip so I could machine gun the bodies. With no Uzi to hand, I began to dog paddle south toward my house. They paced me along the street, he rolling in his whisper-quiet wheelchair, she walking beside him as solemn as a pastor and pausing every now and then to pick up a likely-looking rock. I hadn't swum enough to be tired, but I was. It was mostly shock, I suppose. Finally, I tried to draw a breath at the wrong time, swallowed more water, and panicked completely. I began to swim in toward the shore, wanting to get to where I could stand up. Roget Whitmore began to fire rocks at me immediately, first using the ones she had lined up between her left arm and her midriff, then those she'd stockpiled in DeVore's lap. She was warmed up, she wasn't throwing like a girl anymore, and her aim was deadly. Stones splashed all around me. I batted another away, a big one that likely would have cut open my forehead if it had hit, but her follow-up struck my bicep and tore a long scratch there. Enough. I rolled over and swam back out beyond her range, gasping for breath, trying to keep my head up in spite of the growing ache in the back of my neck. When I was clear, I trod water and looked in at them. Whitmore had come all the way to the edge of the embankment, wanting to get every foot of distance she could, hell, every damned inch. DeVore was parked behind her in his wheelchair. They were both still grinning, and now their faces were as red as the faces of imps in hell. Red sky at night, sailor's delight. Another 20 minutes, and it would be getting dark. Could I keep my head above water for another 20 minutes? I thought so, if I didn't panic again, but not much longer. I thought of drowning in the dark, looking up and seeing Venus just before I went under for the last time, and the panic rat slashed me with its teeth again. The panic rat was worse than Roget and her rocks, much worse. Maybe not worse than DeVore. I looked both ways along the lakefront, checking the street, wherever it wove out of the trees for a dozen feet or a dozen yards. I didn't care about being embarrassed anymore, but I saw no one. Dear God, where was everybody? Gone to the Mountain View in Freiburg for a pizza, or the Village Cafe for a milkshake? What do you want? I called into the old man. Do you want me to tell you I'll butt out of your business? Okay, I'll butt out. He laughed. Do I look like I was born yesterday, Noonan? Well, I hadn't expected it to work. Even if I'd been sincere about it, he wouldn't have believed me. We just want to see how long you can swim, Whitmore said, and threw another rock, a long, lazy toss that fell about 5 feet short of where I was. They mean to kill me, I thought. They really do. Yes, And what was more, they might well get away with it. A crazy idea, both plausible and implausible at the same time, rose in my mind. I could see Rogette Whitmore tacking a notice to the Community Doings Board outside the Lakeview General Store. To the Martians of TR-90, greetings. Mr. Maxwell DeVore, everyone's favorite Martian, will give each resident of the TR $100 if no one will use the street on Friday evening, the 17th of July, between the hours of 6 and 8 p.m. Keep our summer friends away, too, and remember, good Martians are like good monkeys. They see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. I couldn't really believe it, not even in my current situation. And yet I almost could. At the very least, I had to grant him the luck of the devil. Tired, my sneakers heavier than ever, I tried to push one of them off and succeeded only in taking on another mouthful of lake water. They stood there watching me, DeVore occasionally picking the mask up from his lap and having a revivifying suck. I couldn't wait until dark. The sun exits in a hurry here in western Maine, as it does, I guess, in mountain country everywhere. But the twilights are long and lingering. By the time it got dark enough in the west to move without being seen, the moon would have risen in the east. I found myself imagining my obituary in the New York Times, the headline reading, "Popular Romantic Suspense Novelist Drowns in Maine." Deborah Weinstock would provide them with the author photo from the forthcoming Helen's Promise. Harold Oblowski would say all the right things, and he'd also remember to put a modest, but not tiny, death notice in Publishers Weekly. He would go half and half with Putnam's on it, and I sank, swallowed more water, and spat it out. I began pummeling the lake again and forced myself to stop. From the shore, I could hear Rogette Whitmore's tinkling laughter. "You bitch," I thought. "You scrawny bit." "Mike," Joe said. The voice was in my head, but it wasn't the one I make when I'm imagining her side of a mental dialogue, or when I just miss her and need to whistle her up for a while. As if to underline this, something splashed to my right, splashed hard. When I looked in that direction, I saw no fish, not even a ripple. What I saw instead was our swimming float, anchored about 100 yards away in the sunset-colored water. "I can't swim that far, baby," I croaked. "Did you say something, Noonan?" DeVore called from the shore. He cupped a mocking hand to one of his huge wax-lump ears. "Couldn't quite make it out. You sound all out of breath." More tinkling laughter from Whitmore. He was Johnny Carson. She was Ed McMahon. "You can make it. I'll help you." The float, I realized, might be my only chance. There wasn't another one on this part of the shore, and it was at least 10 yards beyond Whitmore's longest rock shot so far. I began to dog paddle in that direction, my arms now as leaden as my feet. Each time I felt my head on the verge of going under, I paused, treading water, telling myself to take it easy. I was in pretty good shape and doing okay, telling myself that if I didn't panic, I'd be all right. The old bitch and the even older bastard resumed pacing me, but they saw where I was headed, and the laughter stopped. So did the taunts. For a long, long time, the swimming float seemed to draw no closer. I told myself that was just because the light was fading, the color of the water draining from red to purple to a near black that was the color of DeVore's gums. But I was able to muster less and less conviction for this idea as my breath shortened and my arms grew heavier. When I was still 30 yards away, a cramp struck my left leg. I rolled sideways like a swamped sailboat, trying to reach the bunched muscle. More water poured down my throat. I tried to cough it out, then retched and went under with my stomach still trying to heave and my fingers still looking for the knotted place above the knee. "I'm really drowning," I thought, strangely calm now that it was happening. "This is how it happens. This is it." Then I felt a hand seize me by the nape of the neck. The pain of having my hair yanked brought me back to reality in a flash. It was better than an epinephrine injection. I felt another hand clamp around my left leg. There was a brief but terrific sense of heat. The cramp let go, and I broke the surface swimming, really swimming this time, not just dog paddling. And in what seemed like seconds, I was clinging to the ladder on the side of the float, breathing in great, snatching gasps, waiting to see if I was going to be all right or if my heart was going to detonate in my chest like a grenade. At last, my lungs started to overcome my oxygen debt, and everything began to calm down. I gave it another minute, then climbed out of the water and into what was now the ashes of twilight. I stood facing west for a little while, bent over with my hands on my knees, dripping on the boards. Then I turned around, meaning this time to flip them not just a single bird, but that fabled double eagle. There was no one to flip it to. The street was empty. DeVore and Roget Whitmore were gone. Maybe they were gone. I'd do well to remember there was a lot of street I couldn't see. I sat cross-legged on the float until the moon rose, waiting and watching for any movement. A half hour, I think. Maybe 45 minutes. I checked my watch, but got no help there. It had shipped some water and stopped at 6:45 p.m. To the other satisfactions DeVore owed me, I could now add the price of one Timex Indiglo. That's $29.95, asshole. Cough it up. At last, I climbed back down the ladder, slipped into the water, and stroked for shore as quietly as I could. I was rested, my head had stopped aching, although the knot above the nape of my neck still throbbed steadily, and I no longer felt off balance and incredulous. In some ways, that had been the worst of it, trying to cope not just with the apparition of the drowned boy, the flying rocks, and the lake, but with the pervasive sense that none of this could be happening, that rich old software moguls did not try to drown novelists who strayed into their line of sight. Had tonight's adventure been a case of simply straying into DeVore's view, though? A coincidental meeting, no more than that? Wasn't it likely he'd been having me watched ever since the 4th of July, maybe from the other side of the lake by people with high-powered optical equipment? Paranoid bullshit, I would have said. At least I would have said it before the two of them almost sank me in Dark Score Lake like a kid's paper boat in a mud puddle. I decided I didn't care who might be watching from the other side of the lake. I didn't care if the two of them were still lurking on one of the tree-shielded parts of the street, either. I swam until I could feel strands of waterweed tickling my ankles and see the crescent of my beach. Then I stood up, wincing at the air, which now felt cold on my skin. I limped to shore, one hand raised to fend off a hail of rocks, but no rocks came. I stood for a moment on the street, my jeans and polo shirt dripping, looking first one way, then the other. It seemed I had this little part of the world to myself. Last, I looked back at the water, where weak moonlight beat a track from the thumbnail of beach out to the swimming float. "Thanks, Joe," I said, then started up the railroad ties to the house. I got about halfway, then had to stop and sit down. I had never been so utterly tired in my whole life. I climbed the stairs to the deck instead of going around to the front door, still moving slowly and marveling at how my legs felt twice their normal weight. When I stepped into the living room, I looked around with the wide eyes of someone who has been away for a decade and returns to find everything just as he left it. Bunter the Moose on the wall, the Boston Globe on the couch, a compilation of tough stuff crossword puzzles on the end table, the plate on the counter with the remains of my stir-fry still on it. Looking at these things brought the realization home full force. I had gone for a walk, leaving all this normal light clutter behind, and had almost died instead. Had almost been murdered. I began to shake. I went into the north wing bathroom, took off my wet shirt, and threw it into the tub. Splat! Then, still shaking, I turned and stared at myself in the mirror over the wash basin. I looked like someone who has been on the losing side in a barroom brawl. One bicep bore a long, clotting gash. A blackish-purple bruise was unfurling what looked like shadowy wings on my left collarbone. There was a bloody furrow on my neck and behind my ear where the lovely Roguette had caught me with the stone in her ring. I took my shaving mirror and used it to check the back of my head. "Can't you get that through your thick skull?" my mother used to shout at me and Sid when we were kids. And now I thank God that Ma had apparently been right about the thickness factor, at least in my case. The spot where DeVore had struck me with his cane looked like the cone of a recently extinct volcano. Whitmore's bullseye had left a red wound that would need stitches if I wanted to avoid a scar. Blood, rusty and thin, stained the nape of my neck all around the hairline. God knew how much had flowed out of that unpleasant-looking red mouth and been washed away by the lake. I poured hydrogen peroxide into my cupped palm, steeled myself, and slapped it onto the gash back there like aftershave. The bite was monstrous, and I had to tighten my lips to keep from crying out. When the pain started to fade a little, I soaked cotton balls with more peroxide and cleaned my other wounds. I showered, threw on a T-shirt and a pair of jeans, then went into the hall to phone the county sheriff. There was no need for directory assistance. The Castle Rock PD and county sheriff's numbers were on the In Case of Emergency card thumbtacked to the bulletin board, along with the numbers for the fire department, the ambulance service, and the 900 number where you could get three answers to that day's Times crossword puzzle for $1.50. I dialed the first three numbers fast, then began to slow down. I got as far as 955-960 before stopping altogether. I stood there in the hall with the phone pressed against my ear, visualizing another headline, this one not in the decorous Times, but the rowdy New York Post. "Novelist to aging CompuKing, you big bully." Along with side-by-side pictures of me, looking roughly my age, and Max DeVore, looking roughly 106. The Post would have great fun telling its readers how DeVore, along with his companion, an elderly lady who might weigh 90 pounds soaking wet, had lumped up a novelist half his age, a guy who looked, in his photograph at least, reasonably trim and fit. The phone got tired of holding only six of the required seven numbers in its rudimentary brain, double-clicked, and dumped me back to an open line. I took the handset away from my ear, stared at it for a moment, and then set it gently back down in its cradle. I'm not a sissy about the sometimes whimsical, sometimes hateful attention of the press, but I'm wary, as I would be around a bad-tempered, fur-bearing mammal. America has turned the people who entertain it into weird high-class whores, and the media jeers at any celeb who dares complain about his or her treatment. "Quit your bitchin'," cry the newspapers and the TV gossip shows. The tone is one of mingled triumph and indignation. "Did you really think we paid you the big bucks just to sing a song or swing a Louisville slugger? Wrong, asshole! We pay so we can be amazed when you do it well, whatever it happens to be in your particular case, and also because it's gratifying when you fuck up. The truth is, your supplies. If you cease to be amusing, we can always kill you and eat you." They can't really eat you, of course. They can print pictures of you with your shirt off and say you're running to fat. They can talk about how much you drink or how many pills you take, or snicker about the night you pulled some starlet onto your lap at Spago and tried to stick your tongue in her ear. But they can't really eat you. So it wasn't the thought of the Post calling me a crybaby or being a part of Jay Leno's opening monologue that made me put the phone down. It was the realization that I had no proof. No one had seen us. And I realized, finding an alibi for himself and his personal assistant would be the easiest thing in the world for Max DeVore. There was one other thing, too, the capper. Imagining the county sheriff sending out George Footman, a.k.a. Daddy,
to take my statement on how the mean man had knocked Lil Mikey into the lake. How the three of them would laugh later on about that. I called John Storrow instead, wanting him to tell me I was doing the right thing, the only thing that made any sense, wanting him to remind me that only desperate men were driven to such desperate lengths. I would ignore, at least for the time being, how the two of them had laughed, as if they were having the time of their lives, and that nothing had changed in regard to Kai DeVore. Her grandfather's custody case still sucked bog water. I got John's recording machine at home and left a message. Just call Mike Noonan, no emergency, but feel free to call late. Then I tried his office, mindful of the scripture according to John Grisham. Young lawyers work until they drop. I listened to the firm's recording machine, then followed instructions and punched STO on my phone keypad, the first three letters of John's last name. There was a click, and then he came on the line. Another recorded version, unfortunately. "Hi, this is John Storrow. I've gone down to Philly for the weekend to see my mom and dad. I'll be in the office on Monday. For the rest of the week, I'll be out on business. From Tuesday to Friday, you'll probably have the most luck trying to reach me at..." The number he gave began 207-955, which meant Castle Rock. I imagined it was the hotel where he'd stayed before, the nice one up on the view. "Mike Noonan," I said. "Call me when you can. I left a message on your apartment machine, too." I went in the kitchen to get a beer, then only stood there in front of the refrigerator, playing with the magnets. "Whoremaster," he'd called me. "Say there, whoremaster, where's your whore?" A minute later, he had offered to save my soul. Quite funny, really. Like an alcoholic offering to take care of your liquor cabinet. "He feels almost related to you," Maddie had said. "Your great-grandfather and his great-grandfather shit in the same pit." I left the fridge with all the beer still safe inside, went back to the phone and called Maddie. "Hi," said another obviously recorded voice. I was on a roll. "It's me, but either I'm out or not able to come to the phone right this minute. Leave a message, okay?" A pause, the mic rustling, a distant whisper, and then Kyra, so loud she almost blew my ear off. "Leave a happy message." What followed was laughter from both of them, cut off by the beep. "Hi, Maddie, it's Mike Noonan," I said. "I just wanted..." I don't know how I would have finished that thought, and I didn't have to. There was a click, and then Maddie herself said, "Hello, Mike." There was such a difference between this dreary, defeated-sounding voice and the cheerful one on the tape that for a moment I was silenced. Then I asked her what was wrong. "Nothing," she said, then began to cry. "Everything. I lost my job. Lindy fired me." Firing wasn't what Lindy had called it, of course. She'd called it belt-tightening, but it was firing, all right, and I knew that if I looked into the funding of the Four Lakes Consolidated Library, I would discover that one of the chief supporters over the years had been Mr. Max DeVore. And he'd continue to be one of the chief supporters, if that was Lindy Briggs played ball. "We shouldn't have talked where she could see us doing it," I said, knowing I could have stayed away from the library completely and Maddie would be just as gone. "And we probably should have seen this coming." John Storrow did see it. She was still crying, but making an effort to get it under control. He said Max DeVore would probably want to make sure I was as deep in the corner as he could push me come the custody hearing. He said DeVore would want to make sure I answered, "I'm unemployed, Your Honor," when the judge asked where I worked. I told John Mrs. Briggs would never do anything so low, especially to a girl who'd given such a brilliant talk on Melville's Bartleby. Do you know what he told me?
No.
He said, "You're very young." I thought that was a patronizing thing to say, but he was right, wasn't he? Maddie, what am I going to do, Mike? What am I going to do? The panic rat had moved on down to Wasp Hill Road, it sounded like. I thought, quite coldly, why not become my mistress? Your title will be research assistant, a perfectly Jake occupation as far as the IRS is concerned. I'll throw in clothes, a couple of charge cards, a house.
say goodbye to the Rust Bucket Double Wide on Wasp Hill Road, and a two-week vacation. How does February on Maui sound? Plus Kai's education, of course, and a hefty cash bonus at the end of the year. I'll be considerate, too. Considerate and discreet. Once or twice a week, and never until your little girl is fast asleep. All you have to do is say yes and give me a key. All you have to do is slide over when I slide in. All you have to do is let me do what I want. All through the dark, all through the night. Let me touch where I want to touch. Let me do what I want to do. Never say no. Never say stop. I closed my eyes. Mike, are you there? Sure, I said. I touched the throbbing gash at the back of my head and winced. You're going to do just fine, Maddie. The trailer's not paid for, she nearly wailed. I have two overdue phone bills, and they're threatening to cut off the service. There's something wrong with the Jeep's transmission and the rear axle as well. I can pay for Kai's last week of vacation Bible school, I guess. Mrs. Briggs gave me 3 weeks' pay in lieu of notice, but how will I buy her shoes? She outgrows everything so fast. There's holes in all her shorts and most of her goddamn underwear. She was starting to weep again. I'm going to take care of you until you get back on your feet, I said. No, I can't let... You can. And for Kyra's sake, you will. Later on, if you still want to, you can pay me back. We'll keep tabs on every dollar and dime, if you like. But I'm going to take care of you. And you'll never have to take off your clothes when I'm with you, I thought. That's a promise, and I'm going to keep it. Mike, you don't have to do this. Maybe, maybe not, but I am going to do it. You just try and stop me. I'd called, meaning to tell her what had happened to me, giving her the humorous version, but that now seemed like the worst idea in the world. This custody thing is going to be over before you know it, and if you can't find anyone brave enough to put you to work down here once it is, I'll find someone up in Derry who'll do it. Besides, tell me the truth. Aren't you starting to feel that it might be time for a change of scenery? She managed a scrap of a laugh. I guess you could say that. Heard from John today? Actually, yes. He's visiting his parents in Philadelphia, but he gave me the number there. I called him. He'd said he was taken with her. Perhaps she was taken with him as well. I told myself the thorny little tug I felt across my emotions at the idea was only my imagination. Tried to tell myself that anyway. What did he say about you losing your job the way you did? The same things you said, but he didn't make me feel safe. You do. I don't know why. I did. I was an older man, and that is our chief attraction to young women. We make them feel safe. He's coming up again Tuesday morning. I said I'd have lunch with him. Smoothly, not a tremor or hesitation in my voice, I said, maybe I could join you. Maddie's own voice warmed at the suggestion. Her ready acceptance made me feel paradoxically guilty. That would be great. Why don't I call him and suggest you both come over here? I could barbecue again. Maybe I'll keep Kai home from VBS and make it a foursome. She's hoping you'll read her another story. She really enjoyed that. That sounds great, I said, and meant it. Adding Kyra made it all seem more natural, less of an intrusion on my part. Also, less like a date on theirs. John could not be accused of taking an unethical interest in his client. In the end, he'd probably thank me. I believe Kai might be ready to move on to Hansel and Gretel. How are you, Maddie? All right? Much better than I was before you called. Good. Things are going to be all right. Promise me. I think I just did. There was a slight pause. Are you all right, Mike? You sound a little... I don't know. A little strange. I'm okay, I said, and I was, for someone who had been pretty sure he was drowning less than an hour ago. Can I ask you one question before I go, because this is driving me crazy? Of course. The night we had dinner, you said DeVore told you his great-grandfather and mine were almost related. Yes, that they shit in the same pit. I thought that was elegant. Did he say anything else? Think hard. She did, but came up with nothing. I told her to call me if something about that conversation did occur to her, or if she got lonely or scared, or if she started to feel worried about anything. I didn't like to say too much, but I had already decided I'd have to have a frank talk with John about my latest adventure. It might be prudent to have the private detective from Lewiston, George Kennedy, like the actor, put a man or two on the TR to keep an eye on Maddie and Kyra. Max DeVore was mad, just as my caretaker had said. I hadn't understood it then, but I did now. Any time I started to doubt, all I had to do was touch the back of my head. I returned to the fridge and once more forgot to open it. My hands went to the magnets instead and began moving them around, watching as words formed, broke apart, evolved. It was a peculiar kind of writing, but it was writing. I could tell by the way I was starting to trance out. That half-hypnotized state is one you cultivate until you can switch it on and off at will. At least you can when things are going well. The intuitive part of the mind unlocks itself when you begin to work and rises to a height of about 6 feet, maybe 10 on good days. Once there, it simply hovers, sending black magic messages and bright pictures. For the balance of the day, that part is locked to the rest of the machinery and goes pretty much forgotten. Except on certain occasions when it comes loose on its own and you trance out unexpectedly, your mind making associations which have nothing to do with rational thought and glaring with unexpected images. That is in some ways the strangest part of the creative process. The muses are ghosts, and sometimes they come uninvited. My house is haunted.
Sarah Laughs has always been haunted. You've stirred him up.
Stirred, I wrote on the refrigerator. But it didn't look right, so I made a circle of fruit and vegetable magnets around it. That was better, much. I stood there for a moment, hands crossed over my chest, as I crossed them at my desk when I was stuck for a word or a phrase, then took off stir and put on haunt, making haunted. It's haunted in the circle, I said, and barely heard the faint chime of Bunter's bell, as if in agreement. I took the letters off, and as I did, found myself thinking how odd it was to have a lawyer named Romeo. Romeo went in the circle, and a detective named George Kennedy. George went up on the fridge. I wondered if Kennedy could help me with Andy Drake, Drake on the fridge, maybe give me some insights. I'd never written about a private detective before, and it's the little stuff. Rake off, leave the D, add e-tails, that makes the difference. I turned a three on its back and put an I beneath it, making a pitchfork. The devil's in the details. From there, I went somewhere else. I don't know where exactly, because I was tranced out, that intuitive part of my mind up so high a search party couldn't have found it. I stood in front of my fridge and played with the letters, spelling out little pieces of thought without even thinking about them. You mightn't believe such a thing is possible, but every writer knows it is. What brought me back was light splashing across the windows of the foyer. I looked up and saw the shape of a car pulling to a stop behind my Chevrolet. A cramp of terror seized my belly. That was a moment when I would have given everything I owned for a loaded gun. Because it was Footman, had to be. DeVore had called him when he and Whitmore got back to Warrington's, had told him Noonan refuses to be a good Martian, so get over there and fix him. When the driver's door opened and the dome light in the visitor's car came on, I breathed a conditional sigh of relief. I didn't know who it was, but it sure wasn't Daddy. This fellow didn't look as if he could take care of a housefly with a rolled-up newspaper. Although, I supposed, there were plenty of people who had made that same mistake about Jeffrey Dahmer. Above the fridge was a cluster of aerosol cans, all of them old and probably not ozone-friendly. I didn't know how Mrs. M. had missed them, but I was pleased she had. I took the first one my hand touched, Black Flag, excellent choice. Thumbed off the cap and stuck the can in my left front pocket. Then I turned to the drawers on the left side of the sink. The top one contained silverware. The second one held what Joe called kitchen shit. Everything from poultry thermometers to those gadgets you stick in corn cobs so you don't burn your fingers off. The third one down held a generous selection of mismatched steak knives. I took one, put it in the right front pocket of my jeans, and went to the door.